Hello. In this ASI cast, Richard Marks speaks with Colin Morrison, publisher of the highly regarded Flashes and Flames blog, which comments on the developing management models of media companies. Ahead of Colin's keynote address at this year's International Publishing and Data Conference in Lisbon, they talk about how publishing will survive in the future. To what extent are people prepared to pay for the information publishers curate and provide for them? How important will advertising revenues continue to be? And why are crosswords so significant?
Welcome to the podcast, Colin. First question I've got is more for our listeners who may not be aware of Flashes and Flames. But what is Flashes and Flames and how did it come into being?
Oh, Flashes and Flames is, I never quite know the difference between a blog and a website in a way, but Flashes and Flames is a blog that's now 8 years old, and it was born of, firstly, for the past 10 years I've earned my living from expressing strong opinions on the management of media companies, and so that was one of my motivations to put some of my ideas out there. Secondly, I wanted to know how blogs worked, and particularly WordPress, and so I did it experimentally, and I discovered I had something like nearly 1,000 regular readers within a few months without even telling anybody about it. So it's grown from there, really, and that was 8 years ago.
And for our international listeners who, you know, some of the subtleties of language might escape non-English speakers, what do flashes and flames, the actual words, mean in a publishing context?
Nothing really at all. I was just I had an eye on using a brand or you know, a domain name that would be memorable and kind of easily said, but it really doesn't mean anything at all. It was, I think, like a lot of our listeners, you know, you end up choosing whatever domains are available. And I didn't want it to be very personal. I didn't want it to be Colin Morrison, to have a prior opinion of me. So I suppose you could say it was flashes of inspiration and flames of destruction, but that wasn't the original intention.
Oh, I thought it might be some really old printing process or something for the flames that were used to melt the letters into the.
I could post rationalize it. That probably sounds like a good way.
Now, your keynote at our conference in Lisbon is going to pose the question: will publishing survive until 2030? It's quite an interesting topic because I was thinking back to about 7-8 years ago when everyone was doing pieces and projects about what will media be like in 2020, and we're only about 5 months away from that. So what would you say are the principal moving parts that will determine whether publishing survives across the next decade?
I think in truth you do have to start by saying, what is publishing? And publishing, in my view, is the curation and packaging of information for readers, listeners and users. And I think whether that process survives as a business, and that's the key part of it, of course, as a business, whether it's in print or online, probably depends more on what kind of information one is talking about. It's like the issue today is often, will people pay for information? And the answer is, people will pay for things that they value. And so just because they don't happen to pay for a certain kind of information doesn't mean they won't pay for any information. So I think straightforwardly, it is breaking into parts the process of what information is being provided for what people, and will they pay for it, and what will they pay for it, and therefore, is it still a business in 2030? So I think those are the issues, really.
It's interesting, it may not be significant, that you didn't mention advertising there in terms of the revenue from advertising, because on a recent ASI podcast we did with James Hughes of FIP, who's speaking in the session that you'll be chairing. I mean, he was fairly bullish. I mean, it's FIP's job to be bullish about publishing, obviously, but he was particularly bullish about the rise of online subscription models, and relatively, I wouldn't say dismissive, but quite downbeat about the contribution that advertising would make in the future. Do you share his optimism about the willingness of consumers to pay?
Yeah, I think it's two different things. I do share his optimism at the willingness of consumers to pay for quite a lot of information of different sorts, but not to accept the bundling of information in the way that print has had it for 100 years, which is you have to buy it all or nothing. So I think readers are showing the willingness to pay for information that they want. But I think the advertising is a critical issue here, because I think that advertising is an ancillary revenue, or should be an ancillary revenue source in the process of people buying and reading information. And I think during the good old days, when advertising was frequently the biggest revenue source for publishers, for many publishers, I think that distorted the relationship and probably gave publishers more difficulty during this period than they would otherwise have had. So I think advertising is now mostly ancillary. And I think, you know, we all know that a large amount of digital advertising has been captured by Facebook, Google, and increasingly Amazon. So I guess it will remain like that.
It's interesting. You mentioned the monetization of standalone elements of content. I guess that would include examples like the New York Times crossword, which you mentioned in a recent blog, for example. There's some interesting parallels with the TV world, and particularly the cable and satellite industry, where unbundling has been a huge issue for quite a while in terms of the reticence of the cable companies in the US and Sky in the UK, for example, to actually say, you can buy this channel, but not that channel. There's always this tendency to say, no, you're buying the kids package or the movie package or whatever. Do you think there's a similar reticence in the publishing industry, that the worry there is that people will only buy the things — it sounds a strange thing when you say it — will only buy the things they want, and they won't buy the things they don't want?
I think that's right. It's partly generational. And young people have been brought up to realize that with iTunes, they can buy the track they want instead of, for some of us, having to buy an album for the two tracks or one track we wanted. And so that's the culture of the time. And of course, young people, however you define it, are the growing part of the market. So I think that must go on like that. The fact is that in print, there was never a choice, because the manufacturing process would have made it uneconomic for you to have your own printed edition of a newspaper or magazine. But clearly in digital, these things can be provided. And the only obstacle currently to unbundling everything, say in the print world, is just publishers who are scared of cannibalizing their existing, albeit declining, publications.
The other area that there's been quite a lot of focus on, that kind of slightly overlaps both the subscription models and the advertising model, is the talk about micropayments. Obviously, you don't have to slightly reverse sometimes and get into a debate about blockchain, and which we won't do on this podcast, but how that has tended to apply in conversations about publishing is in two ways. The first is around the concept of, literally, you mentioned the iTunes model, and it's interesting that the iTunes effectively is shutting down because people aren't buying individual pieces of content, they're buying subscriptions. So one of the potential applications of micropayments would be literally paying per article, that you would be charged 0.01p for every article you read and totted up, bit like an Oyster card. The other is the application for being asked to perform a specific task. And I know one of the site that I write on, MediaTel, has introduced this, where to read a whole article you have to watch an ad and answer a question about it. Do you think that interruptive model is part of the future of advertising, or could it actually be quite dangerous?
Well, I don't think it could be dangerous as such. I can't quite see the danger. the biggest businesses are always going to be ones that have a very simple message and a simple proposition. And a lot of those micropayment kind of options are just presenting too many choices for them to be big enough and pervasive enough as businesses. That's what I think. I think you could do it, and the individual businesses may very well do it successfully. But I suspect there will start to be some very large standardized offers that everybody clearly understands. There might be quite a large number of different offers, but I think that they will be much simpler than that for the mass market.
I guess personally, I can see the idea of the micropayments for content in the literal sense, in that it is almost like a prepaid card where you buy £10 worth of content on the Times and use up your £10 depending on how much you munch your way through. It was more the idea of advertising as an interruptive thing. That the worry I've got about this idea that you watch an ad or answer a question to unlock content, as it's kind of assuming therefore that advertising is something to be endured and done in order to get a prize, which you could argue is quite moving away from the old synergistic relationship that advertising and content used to have in the print world, where people arguably used to love the fact that the September issue of Vogue was 70% advertising because they saw the benefit of it. You know, it's almost this idea, we all know you hate advertising, so just get this done and then you can read this article.
I mean it seems to me the two extremes that can coexist in the future of advertising in relation to publishing, and one is of course data-driven advertising that identifies you as a perfect target for the advertiser. And the other is content marketing, you know, basically sponsored content. And if that's well done, that could work very well. Some of the sponsored content we see in magazines and newspapers seems to me a little bit too cynical. I think if you go back to the sort of soap operas on ancient TV, where really it's perfectly good entertainment that happened to be sponsored by companies that therefore viewers, you know, thought something of for providing it for them. And I think those two extremes, you know, will be major ways that publishers of different sorts can gain advertising. But back to the point that today, where those data tech companies, the large platforms, are dominating digital advertising, they're very good at it, and they're very good at delivering the data and understanding the data and managing the data. And I don't think it would be very easy for people we currently call publishers to really get a large share of advertising again.
Because there's arguably a third way in this scenario, which is that's been pursued by The Guardian. You wrote a really interesting article I think a week or two ago about the whole history of how The Guardian went from the precipice of where it was under Rusbridge financially to actually breaking even or making a small profit in the newspaper element of The Guardian last year. Do you think that model, which is obviously a voluntary, they describe it as a membership model as opposed to a subscription model, do you think that's unique to The Guardian and certain brands that have that prestige that people will reach into their pocket to keep them going? Or is that something that could be considered more widely by publishers?
Well, I think The Guardian, there's several special aspects of The Guardian, one of which, of course, it's owned by a not-for-profit, which is sort of understood by its readership. So it is a slightly different organization asking for support. So that does create a separate series of opportunities. I think a lot of, and therefore the observations I can make about the difficulties of translating the Guardian idea to others should be read into that context, because I think that The Guardian has a really commendable large amount of support that has turned into financial support, and it does look quite promising. But it's pretty bespoke and pretty individual. People are more or less paying what they feel like paying. Some of them are just paying more or less when they feel like paying it. Which again doesn't sound like necessarily the kind of process that will best serve a hard-driving commercial business. I think most often subscribers will have to be part of a kind of a standardized process in order for this this revenue to be generated efficiently. I think it will be more like that. Now, in a sense, if you try to standardize a package, you inevitably it will tend to be reducing the price. But I think that that's one of the challenges also for publishers of getting the price right in order to get the size of market you want.
There may also be an element, I don't know if it's just my take on it, but particularly when you look at the New York Times and the Guardian, the successes they've had around the membership and the subscription model have coincided with a period of extreme international crisis and disquiet, and particularly the rise of Trump and Brexit, and this feeling that those two publishers in particular are kind of a rallying point for the resistance, capital T, capital R, that ironically they may not be have done quite so well had we been living through an Ed Miliband Labour government and a Hillary Clinton in the White House, that actually the crisis we're in has actually made people think, God, we need to support these people because, we need these voices.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in that. And I think they have to remember that the model that might be starting to work now might not fare so well in the years ahead. I mean, I think the New York Times distinction of being able to sell 550,000 subscriptions to the Daily Crossword, however, is something significant. Mm. It shows that some newspapers got highly attractive individual elements that can sometimes be sold for a price that's disproportionately large against the price of the whole newspaper.
Well, my mum buys the Daily Telegraph despite not even supporting Brexit, purely for the crossword.
I think people in America and Britain absolutely understand that and have done for decades. And it's interesting that only the New York Times has decided to recognise it and to risk a little bit of current money from the newspaper in order to exploit it.
Finally, an important issue for researchers in our audience in Lisbon is going to be the long-term future of specifically the print medium for publishers. Because put simply, it's much more expensive to measure and produce audience figures for print, where you actually have to go out and interview people about what they do, as opposed to online, where you can be looking at the digital tea leaves that are left behind by people's online behaviour. What role do you see print as playing by 2030? Is it managed decline, or is the rise of free newspapers like Metro and the Standard actually securing an element of print being in the future?
Well, I think most research, let's face it, is for the benefit of advertisers to measure impact in order to sell advertising. So what I would say about print is that print is not only getting less of a share of advertising than it has ever got, and that looks like a systemic decline, but also print is becoming a smaller business than it ever was before. I think print will be there for as long as humans are on this earth, almost, but it will be a much smaller business. So I think that the emphasis will be on online. Whether it's the same publishers as today are doing so much in print or not. So I think that point for researchers will be that their new emphasis on online will grow and grow, and there will hardly be any research in print, I would guess.
Well, it's definitely one of the topics we'll be debating, not least in at the end of the second day, where we've got a panel titled where do we go from here, and that's specifically in terms of how do we research all that stuff. But anyway, thanks for your time, Colin. We'll hold back any further conversation for your session, where you'll also, as well as delivering the keynote, you'll also have papers from the BBC, from VRT in Belgium, from ComScore, and from FIP themselves, who I mentioned, the Federation of International Periodical Publishers. So thanks for your time, and we'll see you in Lisbon.
Thank you. I look forward to it.